Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Assad is gone. Now what? What about Syria? Is it gone too? It would seem so. Outside powers are carving up the country. What was an international proxy war against Damascus is turning into an international civil war. Is there a place for the Syrian people? Crosstalking Syria, I'm joined by my guest Ali Rizki in Beirut. He is a security and political affairs analyst. Also in Lebanon, we have Hisham Safadin. He is an associate professor and Canada research chair in the history of the modern Middle East at the University of British Columbia. And in Manchester, we cross to Peter Ford. He is a former British ambassador to Bahrain and Syria. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I would appreciate it every single time. Ambassador Ford, if I can go to you first. In Manchester, the title of this program, Does Syria Have a Future? And if it does, what is it? Go ahead.
I'm afraid that future looks very bleak indeed. Now, of course, the media in the West have been emphasizing the positive, and the word which keeps cropping up is jubilation. Jubilation, because there are some people in the streets who are obviously overjoyed at the removal of Bashar. But that's only half the picture. If they took their cameras to the border with Lebanon and interviewed some of the thousands streaming out every day in fear for their lives, jubilation would not be the word coming to their lips. So basically, half of Syria appears to be looking forward to the kind of future that they want, an Islamist future, and the other half or more are dreading it.
Well, Ali, you know, there was the famous phrase that goes back to Condoleezza Rice, you know, creating the new Middle East. Well, I suppose there is a new Middle East now, but is anyone's security been enhanced with this dramatic change in Syria? Ali in Beirut.
I think that the main beneficiary, or there are two main beneficiaries, as we all know, regarding the events in Syria. In the immediate future, in the near term, you have Israel and Turkey, each for their own reasons. I think that the Israelis have played a major, major part in how the situation has unfolded. It was before, right before the events in Syria, where Benjamin Netanyahu spoke about a new Middle East. Now, it appears that for the time being, his interest or the Israeli interests converged with the Turkish interests. I'm not sure how long that's going to take. I think we're already starting to see some rivalry emerging between the Turkish and the Israeli agendas. And I think that nobody's security has been enhanced. I don't think Turkish security, by the way, has been enhanced. HTS is still designated as a terrorist group. Turkey, if you remember before, it was subject to terrorist attacks by ISIS and by other groups, and there's a real, real chance that ISIS can take advantage of what has taken place. This is a very, very good environment for ISIS to thrive in. For the Israelis, I think that their expansionist agenda, it has to be admitted, it has been so. They've expanded into Syria, occupied additional territories. So their ambitions, Netanyahu's ambitions, have been served. And it's interesting to note that Salafi jihadis do not have a history of targeting Israel. That's even right. The former head of the Mossad, he stated this back in 2016. So I see that the Israelis have benefited. And as your previous guest mentioned, I don't think this is a cause for celebration by Washington. The Biden administration has spoken about how they contributed to what has taken place. But in the end, I don't think that this serves American interests for there to be a Salafi jihadi-led country emerging in Syria, or for there to be even a weak state in Syria, because, as I said, that serves ISIS, and particularly for President-elect Biden, that would be a disaster because President-elect Trump, sorry, that will be a disaster for him, because under his watch, we saw ISIS being degraded, and he took responsibility for the assassination of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, if you recall.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for. It's always the case here. Shiham, if I can go to you also in Lebanon here. What is the future of this region? Is it neo-Ottomanism? Is it Zionist? Is it American hegemony? I mean, they all can't commingle together for long. Go ahead.
Well, I think at this point, it's difficult to see how things are going to go, but we do have some indications in relation to what happened in Syria that, as has been mentioned, although I disagree about the whether this benefits or doesn't benefit the United States, but we do have two big winners on the geopolitical stage, which is Turkey and Israel. I think we have to look at more than one dimension. So one of the dimensions has to do with the military struggle, with the military resistance, armed resistance against Israel, and the hegemony and the presence of U.S. forces in the region, including in northeastern Syria, the future of U.S. military bases in the region. So that's one dimension. The second one has to do with the economic dimension. No matter what we think about whether these groups, these Salafi Islamist groups, are in line or not in line with Western ideology, if they adopt a neoliberal economic model, if they open up Syria for investments, foreign investments, if they actually resuscitate Bashar's own neoliberal policies that brought Turkey, economic Turkish power into the region, then we may be seeing a kind of like, so to speak, Gulfization of Syria, a realignment of Syria along these lines. So that could be one of the futures that we're looking at. And that definitely is very worrisome because the level of destruction of the Syrian economy, of Syrian infrastructure, if this is going to be a new oligarchy that's just has an Islamist flavor, which is, again, a resuscitation of Bashar's own oligarchy, then that's also a cause of concern. And lastly, maybe I'm going back to the first point, I do think this is a lose situation for the axis of resistance. There's no question about
that. Okay, I'll get to that in the second part of the program. That's one of my questions here. Ambassador Ford, what about that? I mean, if there's going to be any kind of economic rebuilding, and you need security, but I don't see the elements of security in the present, even going into the future. I don't see how this is going to pan out. There are too many competing interests.
Well, the two key questions here are sanctions relief and the oil. Now, there's an indecent rush towards sanctions relief on the part of most of the Western powers, and many of the public relations efforts of the jihadi regime are directed towards this, because it was basically sanctions that did for Bashar, and it may well do for the new regime if they're not lifted, and therefore people's hopes are dashed. The United States seems in two minds on sanctions relief. On the one hand, they're inclined to indulge and consolidate their new pets who are in power in Damascus. But on the other, they seem to be hearing Israeli voices saying, hey, don't be so quick. You don't owe these people any favors. They're not even useful to you anymore. They've done their job. They got rid of the Russians, they got rid of Iran, they got rid of Bashar. You don't need to make nice with these people. So I sense that the United States, as usual, will listen to the Israelis on this and will drag its heels on sanctions relief. On the oil, I think the U.S. is in a bind, and they will end up surrendering it to the jihadis. Those U.S. troops had one main function, to stop Assad getting his hands on the oil. In theory, the troops were there to fight ISIS. That was a fiction. No, it was to stop Assad getting the oil and to use the proceeds from sale of the oil to fund the Kurdish Autonomous Administration. Well, the U.S. doesn't need the Kurds anymore. It can let the Kurds go.
Yeah,
but, and I think this is what will happen.
Yeah, Ali, I mean, does the Western powers have any interest in a recovering Syria? I mean, just leave it as a wasteland. Doesn't that serve a purpose for the West, for Israel, even for Turkey?
I think that the West's policy towards Syria is very much to a large degree dictated by Israel. I think that's how the West sees the situation in Syria. But regarding the issue of sanctions, there's an important point I think we have to remember. We're talking about a group which outgrew from Al-Qaeda in the end. HTS usually was formerly Al-Nusra. Al-Nusra was the affiliate, the official affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Now, you're talking about Al-Qaeda, which was behind the coups of September 11. So I don't think it's going to be that easy, whether Israel wants it or not, whether it wants the sanctions to remain or not. It's not going to be very easy for any American administration, I think, to remove these sanctions. That would put it in a very difficult situation. You're talking about the worst ever foreign terrorist attack on the U.S. homeland. That in of itself, I think, is a big obstacle. Now, I think that when it comes to West's vital interests, I'm not talking about Israel's interests, the West's vital interests, they lie in having a non-Salafi jihadi takeover of Syria. Now, regarding the neoliberal outlook, which the colleague in Beirut mentioned, I think that Julani or Ahmad al-Sharra, he is trying, he possibly is sincere regarding opening up Syria, adopting a more moderate stance. That might be true. But there are a lot of other hardline elements within HTS who would disagree. And I think that's going to be a major issue for Julani. Many of these people could be vulnerable and could defect to ISIS, for example. The U.S. sanctions, which I expect to continue to remain in place, given the Al-Qaeda link, that's also going to be another obstacle. So there are various issues at play, I think, which would pose a really, really big challenge and difficulty for Julani to open up.
It's very interesting. We're all talking about the interests of other countries, but not really the interests of the Syrian people. I think that's the point of the program. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue more discussion on Syria. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Syria. Okay, let's go back to one of our guests in Lebanon. Hisham, you mentioned the resistance. What is the state of the resistance? Okay, we have to remind everyone. Hamas may not be destroyed, but Gaza certainly is, and a genocide continues as we're talking about Syria. Depending on who you want to believe, Hezbollah is on the back foot, not defeated, but certainly been injured. Syria, miraculously, has just collapsed. Where does the resistance stand? Or should we even be talking about the resistance anymore? Go ahead.
Well, we certainly should, and the resistance is still present. The resistance, in some respects, is still very strong. And actually, if we start with Gaza and move around, we can see, as you mentioned, that we are actually witnessing continued resistance, happening every day. We have actually casualties on the Israeli side. That being said, of course, the situation in Gaza is disastrous, and Israel continues to occupy territory. It continues to conduct large-scale destructive raids on Gaza and displace and kill Palestinians. On the Lebanese front, the ceasefire that we have seen has stopped the fighting. So that's one setback if we think about the idea of the unity of fronts. At the same time, Israel has failed to actually take hold of Lebanese territory in the south. But there's a lot of ambiguity about the conditions of the ceasefire. There's constant violations happening. The Yemenis are still conducting long-range operations, but they're not perhaps as frequent. And as you mentioned, the Syrian army has been, part of it has been obliterated. The non-state actors have shown extreme resilience, I should say. These are the Houthis, the Hamas, and Hezbollah. At the same time, they are facing a serious challenge because in the case of Lebanon, the supply lines have been cut by the new rulers of Damascus. Syria was a geostrategic depth, offered geostrategic depth to the resistance. Iran is now kind of also somehow giving a lot of diplomatic signals. It's not conducting any attacks as it used to. So I believe that, of course, so long as there is occupation, and now with Israel's expansion and the land grab in Syria, we are going to see continued resistance. But the Axis itself, as a viable long-term coalition, is, in my opinion, objectively speaking, under enormous strain, and its future is uncertain. And that actually cast a serious question over the question of armed resistance vis-a-vis other forms of struggle to liberate Palestine.
Ambassador Ford, let's continue with Iran here. The appetite comes with the eating. We obviously know that the Netanyahu government has been, for as long as he's been in power, been pressuring the United States to go on a military adventure against Iran. What are the possibilities of that now, particularly the interim before the next administration?
Well, Iran has suffered a major, major blow by the loss of its soft underbelly, Syria. Now the Israelis are boasting that they have a corridor, an air corridor to Tehran. And it's true that all those early warning stations are obliterated. It will be much easier now for Israeli aircraft to reach Iranian airspace, which is a scary thought. It will incline the Israelis towards adventurism. And with the prospect of their friend Donald Trump coming to power very soon, it's probably wise of the Iranians to tone things down a bit and to show their better face. And what I think Iran really needs to do is concentrate on shoring up their ally, their remaining ally in Lebanon, which will need even more support. How that support has got to them logistically is a major, major problem. But it may be that for the longer term, Hezbollah needs to reconceptualize itself, no longer present itself so much as a member of the resistance and concentrate on its own position in Lebanon and on the position of its constituency, mainly the Shia community in Lebanon. Because when we look back at the wisdom of joining Hamas after October 2023, I think we have to do our self-criticism and say that it was not wise. But that's easy to say with hindsight.
Well, let's go back to Ali. I started out with Iran, but I mean, a country that is very, very weak, obviously, is Lebanon. I mean, I could foresee, considering the instability in the region, that there would be an attempt for regime change in Beirut.
Well, I'm not sure you can apply the term regime change to Beirut. Lebanese government comes in and out. There's no presidency. There's not really a regime.
That's a good point. Good point.
But when it comes, there have been fears raised about Israelis resuming their war on Lebanon after the expiration of the 60-day period, which is that period where the steps should be taken to further implement and enforce the ceasefire. The argument is based on the assumption that the fall of Assad strengthens Israel's hand, weakens Hezbollah, so therefore Israel can seize the opportunity and deal the knockout blow to Hezbollah. Personally, I don't think that is a likely scenario. I think that the Americans in particular have invested a lot in the ceasefire, and I think that the incoming Trump administration does not want the situation to deteriorate in Lebanon. In fact, I think one of the factors which led to the ceasefire was the ultimatum which Trump gave, if you remember, when he visited that restaurant in Michigan, and he focused on the necessity of bringing an end to the war in Lebanon, in addition to the fact that Hezbollah was able to absorb these unprecedented blows and continue to launch missiles on the Israeli home front. You know, it was down and out, and it remains to be down and out. Quickly about what Ambassador Ford mentioned regarding Hezbollah's priorities, I think that Hezbollah, if you look at the statements or the speeches being given by its new Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim, it is focusing on the domestic situation and shoring up its situation domestically without disregarding the resistance. So Hezbollah is in this process of reassessment, of reevaluating, sorting out its priorities. And Sheikh Naim Qasim, by the way, he was the one who used to be assigned with the task of the Lebanese domestic situation. So he is more well placed than others to, you know, deal with the situation and focus on the domestic angle of Hezbollah's strategy.
Hisham, the former leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, he famously said, without Syria, there is no Palestine. Can you reflect upon that statement?
Well, let me first say that it would be a mistake to think of Hezbollah's intervention as unwise in any way, shape, or form. But precisely because we have to remember that the Al-Aqsa flood operation and what happened after was a turning point in the liberation of Palestine because of this idea of a unity of fronts. This actually emphasizes the transsectarian nature. It would be very dangerous if actually Hezbollah simply withdrew into its quote-unquote Shia environment and kind of became too embedded in the Lebanese domestic front, because that's generally a recipe for increased reactionary politics inside Lebanon. A lot of Hezbollah's politics inside Lebanon is not different from others. What actually stood out for Hezbollah historically is its actually resistance, its opposition to Israeli settler colonialism. So it's very important to maintain that, while of course taking into account how to survive in a hostile environment, how to prevent further erosion of any deterrence of Hezbollah. So I think we have to balance these two things and not simply shift to a domestic agenda. And of course, reconstruction in South Lebanon is itself a form of resistance. The strengthening of people's ability to go back to their homes is a form of resistance, but it has to be framed in that way, as opposed to actually caring more about what's happening within Lebanon. Now, your question about Syria. Historically, Syria, Martin Nasrallah said is absolutely true. Syria is at the heart of, the struggle for Palestine. From the very outset, it's actually a center for Arab national ideology that was very much about the liberation of Palestine as Arab land. It was involved in all the wars with Israel, and it has been, unfortunately, perhaps the only government that was willing to support armed resistance. We shouldn't forget at the same time that the cause, the Palestinian cause, is not just the cause of Hezbollah or Syria. It's also the cause of Jordan. It's the cause of Egypt, let alone the cause of the world around. So what I think is important at this juncture is to start pushing for a wider network of supporters of armed resistance beyond Syria as well, to actually start to think about why isn't Jordan or the people in Jordan, they need to also activate their grassroots movement, their political parties. The more the Syrian front is neutralized, the more that we have to think about sustaining other fronts and not actually shutting them all down so that the only remaining front is Gaza, which is a serious problem in the future.
Okay, Ambassador, before we just have a few seconds left here, what's to stop Israel from continuing its expansion? Go ahead.
Well, the lesson of the last 2 years is that only one thing can stop Israel, and that's the military opposition that it meets, because it's brushed aside everything else. U.S. pressure virtually non-existent. Action in the UN, legal action, media opposition, changes in public opinion across the world. Israel is now a lawless state. It's acting without restraints, and it feels that it can get away with anything, and that's been proven repeatedly over the
months. On that note, gentlemen, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Manchester and in Lebanon, and I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.